Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Hey, it's Adam Carolla. You may know him from putting his body on the line in Jackass, but now Johnny Knoxville is bringing you the wildest stories from the bravest folks he knows on his newest podcast, Pretty Sure I Can Fly. With his co-host, Elna Baker, they have incredible firsthand accounts from folks who surfed 100-foot waves, ride 600 miles per hour in a rocket sled, and wrestle crocodiles just for fun. They've been talking with brave souls who throw caution to the wind and push the boundaries of what humans are capable of. Or, as Johnny would say, they're talking to people who have more balls than a bowling alley. I'm Pretty Sure I Can Fly. Johnny and Elna bring you personal stories from unsung heroes that are part comedy, part adrenaline, and all heart. These are the inspirational, hold my beer stories that will make you want to grab the bull by the horns, literally and figuratively. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcast. You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly right now, early and free, right now on Wondery Plus. So we have the news, and then Delroy Lindo, great actor. Delroy Lindo is on the show as well. First, I'll tell you about Tommy John, working from home, sitting, standing, and squatting, and picking up kids' toys, and filling up dog bowls. Takes its toll. Tommy John, they know life's got its ups and downs. Their new and improved men's underwear is making it more resilient, two times more durable, and right now, for all the customers, at 25% off site-wide. Upgrade to the softest, most breathable fabrics you've ever worn. They got a no wedgie guarantee for the ladies, or no panty lines for the ladies, and no wedgie guarantee for the fellas. So am I wearing my blue ones? Yes, I am. Right now, great undershirts, great loungewear, super soft and comfortable loungewear, and the underwear. It'll ruin you for all others. It's the best. It's Tommy John, right, Dawson?
Hurry to TommyJohn.com/Adam and get 25% off your order. That's TommyJohn.com/Adam for 25% off orders. See site for details.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gino Grad. Breaking viral. All those crazy Trump tweets. Give me news with Gino Grad. Troubles in the Middle East. Celebrity drunk meltdowns. Need news with Gino Grad.
The news with Gina Grad.
So it might still be going as we record right now, but George Floyd's family held the first of several memorial services Thursday afternoon in Minneapolis. His family, friends, and a number of guests gathered at North Central University. That's in Minneapolis. Al Sharpton delivered a eulogy. Jesse Jackson was there, the mayor, Jacob Frey. Saturday, there'll be a public viewing and a private memorial service in North Carolina. That's where he was born. Monday, he'll be flown to Houston for a public and private service. That's kind of where he grew up. And so there'll be a succession of them over the next week.
I don't have anything else to say about it. Everyone knows. We never stop talking about it. It's that. That's it. Here we go. What's next?
Let's see. Oh, this was, we're hearing a lot on, you know, if Antifa and these extreme groups. And the latest one that was in the news is a trio of, according to the New York Post, a trio of right wing extremists with military backgrounds have been busted for plotting riots at some of the protests in Vegas. This was part of their plan to overthrow the government, according to federal prosecutors. So there's three dudes, a 23-year-old, a 35-year-old, and a 40-year-old. One's in the Army Reserve, one's from the Navy, one's from the Air Force. And they're being held on $1 million bond each on terrorism-related charges.
They're military guys, huh?
They're military, and they're part of a movement called the Boogaloo Movement.
Oh, I've heard about that.
I've never heard of this. It's a term used by extremists to signify the coming civil war and or fall of civilization.
I have their theme song, Maxipata. You have to look up from the early 70s. There was a TV show called The Bugaloos, which if they were smart, they would tweak it just a little bit. I think it was an English based, it was out of England, probably Saturday morning, 70s. Yeah,
NBC Saturday morning, 70 to 72.
Find that theme, and let's see if maybe we could...
It's American.
I'll pitch it at the next Boogaloo.
And it's Sid and Marty Krofft.
Oh, yeah. No, no. These guys are really good at what they do. I'll pitch it at our next Boogaloo meeting. The Bugaloos. Here's the theme. Sorry. This is just done in real time, so take a second. All right. It's got the right tempo.
The Bugaloos. We're in the air and everywhere. Flying high. Flying loose. Flying free as a summer breeze. Happy as a summer breeze.
Martha Ray.
That's Benita Bazaar.
The Bugaloos. The Bugaloos, we're in the air and everywhere.
Yeah, I think that fits.
And we can, I'll bring it up the next meeting.
And they each, their characters are named Courage and Joy. You can each adopt a nickname.
Yeah, it'd be fun. It's weird. They sound English when they sing, which made me think they're English. Anyway.
And that was the guy who wrote The Love Boat. The same
same guy wrote The Love Boat?
Yeah.
That's a national hero.
Charles Fox. Yeah.
Wow. All right, so world's ending. What else we got?
Well, Jake Paul, talk about arrests. He is now, police have confirmed to Fox News that YouTube star Jake Paul, brother of Logan Paul, was charged with criminal trespass and unlawful assembly, which are both misdemeanor charges, after his alleged participation in a mall riot. I think we have some of that footage over the weekend. He denied it. He denied looting and all that kind of, and he issued a statement saying neither I nor anyone in our group was engaged in any looting or vandalism, but then this clip went viral.
Oh my God!
Getting crazy outside of PF Chang's.
Oh, my God, it's getting crazy.
Oh, don't loot the PF Chang's, for the love of Christ.
Did not participate
whatever you do.
In looting
put
and
those lettuce cups
at an
down.
Mall.
That's all I got to live for.
The star and his team members at the Scottsdale Fashion Square was posted to Instagram by Andrew Blue, who claims to be Logan's videographer.
Who'd Andrew Blue?
The video shows people breaking windows of the shopping center outside. It also shows what happened inside, including people smashing the windows of a display car and entering a Sephora through the broken glass door.
Hey, yo.
All right.
He says, give me a free cologne.
But aren't we, I mean, don't these guys just do outrageous things all day and then film themselves and then put on the internet so we talk about it?
Yes.
Done and done.
If there's footage of him doing something, throwing a brick or taking a something, or that's one thing. But if he's just there, I don't know, man. It feels like malicious prosecution.
Garagus.
Yeah, yeah. There's a problem with the world of, you know, former bachelorette star does bootleg porn. Like, are we surprised that people that make a living filming themselves doing stupid things and then putting it on the internet or showing up on the internet doing stupid things?
I don't think we're surprised. I think they're surprised when they get in trouble. That's what I think the angle is.
I've seen the
because this is their livelihood. This is what they do. So this, I would imagine, it's pretty shocking to actually be held accountable by the police in Arizona.
I wonder if this is going to be the version. You know, as all these chicks are doing this, like, you know, backyard porn. You know, just with porn with their boyfriend and like throwing it up on the porn sites and everything. And then you go, yeah, but when you're 50 years old, are you really going to be happy that that's out there? There's got to be a looting version of this, right? Bunch of 17 and 19 year olds like looking at the camera and waving and grabbing some basket full of soap or something and running out. That person's going to have to live with that on the internet for the next 100 years too, right?
Yeah, it's not a great look.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you can't rent a car until you're 25.
All right.
So some good news for you NBA lovers. They are set to come back, becoming the first major American sports league to return to action, with play scheduled to resume on July 31st.
I had this corny thought, but I started to think about it when I was driving in tonight. Like, maybe these big sporting events keep a lot of people occupied and distracted. I mean, if you think about sports, it's really a massive distraction. People talking before the game about how the game's going to turn out, then after the game and all the rotisserie leagues and fantasy leagues and all. Everyone's sitting on the internet looking up ESPN.com to figure out how many points their tight end got in his roto league and blah, blah, blah. And you start really think, I was thinking about like, one of the sayings that I've really thought was very, very true, which is the devil makes work for idle hands. And you're seeing it now, locked up, nothing to do. And the devil's making a lot of work for a lot of idle hands out there. Sports, it gives us all something to concern ourselves with, to focus on, a direction to look. Right. And if you take away our sports for a prolonged period of time, those idle hands will find some deviltry. So maybe we need to bring sports back literally to save America. Like maybe we should be saying, look, maybe it's a little risky to get the NBA up and running sooner than later, baseball, whatever, but like we need it as like a war effort. You know what right. I mean? Like we're recycling, you know, rubber and beef and steel. Like we're doing, like it's like a war effort. Like NBA, go back and do your part for America. Let's get that first game up on TV and get America back in their houses and watching sure. that sport.
Yeah, well, that's what they're trying to do. So they've been stopped, obviously, because of the pandemic there in March. But the league's board of governors have approved a plan that will see the 22 teams still in playoff contention travel to Disney World in Orlando. It's all going to be done at that complex to play 8 regular season games. So the plan, according to ESPN, includes 13 Western Conference teams, 9 Eastern Conference teams, 8 regular season games, a possible play-in tournament for the 8th seed in playoffs. So I think they want to get this moving as quickly as possible, and you're not going to play hundreds of games.
I don't know what you guys' thoughts are, but every day, every night, I turn on the news. I'm watching Anderson Cooper last night, and they're showing all these great, beautiful, peaceful protests all around Washington and Boston and L.A. and New York and just hordes of people all sitting against each other peacefully, you know, and Anderson is commenting on how beautiful it is, black and white and Hispanic and gay and straight all coming together, united under one cause. And I keep looking at it going, are we going to keep having these discussions about, well, we can have an NBA game, but we can't have people in the arena, or if they are in the arena, they have to be on separate ends of the arena. Isn't this going on 24/7 times millions of Americans? And if nothing comes of it, then when we start talking about, like, I get to do my vintage race at Laguna Seca in the middle of August, you know, and it's like, we're not sure if we're going to let crowds into the infield or if we're just going to have no crowds. And it's like, aren't we doing this experiment right now with just tons and tons and tons of people all sitting on top of each other? I mean, you would never be that close to somebody on the beach or maybe even in a stadium, certainly not at a park. I mean, these people are, I'm seeing pictures of people just piled in together, back, you know, rows going back as far as the eye can see. I'm confused by if we're not getting a surge, then what are we talking about?
You should ask Drew about this because he'll obviously know more than me. I just see stories and studies and headlines, but I see like they're saying now there's a big difference between your the aforementioned the outdoors, your beloved beach, and the protests or the aforementioned race versus being indoors at a restaurant with the circulated air and such. So obviously more, you know, data is coming out, so to speak, but I think that's going to be, in retrospect, that'll probably be one of the like, oh, we could have let people inside more.
Yeah, there's also this research coming out of a university in Israel that they're working on manufacturing these disinfectant tunnels for stadiums.
Oh,
so when you
walk
through it, you're sprayed and it's completely, they say it's not harmful to the skin. It's not harmful if it gets on your
food.
Yeah, essentially. Like, and you walk right through, like basically you walk right through a mist and it doesn't hurt your skin. So those could start popping up in various, concerts, sporting events.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, now I'm angry because I remember when Anderson Cooper was describing how beautiful it was, part of his commentary was, these people are out there putting themselves in harm's way with the COVID virus and a potential killer, but they're still willing to go out there for the right cause. And I thought, wait a minute, weren't you the one who was saying a month ago when people said, hey, it's my decision if I want to go to the fucking pool or not, you were yelling, no, it's not your decision because you're going to come back and you're going to get grandpa sick. So which is it, Anderson? Are these guys heroes for going out and protesting or and risking their own life, or are they going to come home and get grandpa sick? It's, you got to stick to one theme. The theme used to be, you can't live your life. You're endangering my life when you live your life. Now that theme's out the fucking window. They're just all heroes who are out living their life and risking potential death for them. But only them. No more theme of coming back and killing people in your apartment building. Okay. Well, there you go. Very consistent.
That clears it up.
Glad to know. I'll be prepared for the next time you give me a lecture about bringing something back and killing you. Ugh. Jesus Christ.
Can I put you in a better mood, please?
Mm-hmm.
Vegas.
Yeah.
Opening back up. It opened up Wednesday night at midnight. Gamblers fully out in effect, lined up at various casinos, many gathering on Fremont Street downtown to party before they went inside. Things don't look the same. We know that. The disinfected dice, hand sanitizer, face masks, limited number of players at tables, temperature checks at entrances, touchless cell phone check-ins be the new norm. Some casinos have removed a number of slot machines, so there's 6 feet apart. Some are not obeying, you know, all of these rules, but this is supposed to be the standard as casinos open back up.
Coming full circle to Frank Sinatra lyrics. I was thinking about luck be a lady tonight and blow on some other guy's dice.
Dice.
Yeah, no more blowing on dice.
Right.
Well, I guess you could do it through a mask. Like if
the luck doesn't really transfer.
If I wanted to
see one of those compressed air.
Oh, she gets one of those canisters used to clean your keyboard.
Yeah.
Or to clear the one that the camera guy has in his belt to clean the lens. That guy. Just say I'll get my pretty young side piece there to just blow on it, but I'll have her put the mask on first and then we'll take her word for it.
Smart.
That's sexy.
All right. What else?
So we all know about happy hour at the bars that might be a thing of the past right now. But as things start to open back up, the Federation of Belgian Cafes, yes, there is a Federation of Belgian Cafes in Belgium, is promoting this new campaign to change happy hour to helpy hour. So the difference is happy hour, obviously, it's usually a 2-for-1 special. Helpy hour is buy one for the price of two. It's a way to get bars back on their feet, restaurants back on their feet amid all these shutdowns. Bars and restaurants in Belgium will be allowed to reopen starting Monday under strict conditions, tables spaced apart, and you know, maximum 10 people per table.
Let's think about this. I always try to look at yardsticks to kind of measure societies I'd like to live in. Outdoor eating and drinking sort of per capita. You know, when you just take the United States, you take where we live. We live in Los Angeles. You know, you go down to parts of Sun Valley, Van Nuys, Pacoima, Canoga Park, Chatsworth, all shitholes no one would ever want to live in. Not a lot of outdoor dining.
Al fresco.
But you head into Newport Beach or whatever island in there.
Anything with a marina.
Balboa Island. Like you picture a lot out, and then you picture like Italy and Sweden. You know, like whenever they'd show Sweden, they're not locked down. By the way, where are our Sweden updates? I don't feel like I'm getting any more Sweden. They're going to be an experiment. Like whenever somebody says to me, hey, how come we don't get any updates on fill in the blank, like Sweden or Florida or something? I go, well, that because the news is good. Otherwise, we would get an update. Believe me, if it was a shit show, we would get an update. If you haven't heard anything about it, then it means it's going along fine, or it's not. It's doing comparatively well compared to whatever it is we're doing. But the more outdoor dining, that's the state, that's the city, that's the country, that's where I'd like, That's where I'd like to eat. But you have to have indoor as an option, because I've been to some shitholes where it's all outdoors.
I was just about to say.
That's a good rich man, poor man, because sometimes it's just a picnic table.
I think there's a lot of places in the Middle East you wouldn't want to go to that are exclusively outdoor.
There's two things. All right, I've thought about this. You have to have a 2-to-1 ratio for every 10 seats outdoors. You need 20 seats indoors, number one. And then number two, you have to drink martinis and or mixed drinks. No tea. Tea's trouble. I don't trust the tea countries.
No sweet tea.
No tea.
Wait, Japan's a tea country. You love Japan.
I don't know. Do they do a lot of sitting out? In eating,
I haven't been there.
Gina studied
like Japanese culture or something.
Yeah, but not in a city like Tokyo. I mean, it's like a big
two rules
urban city.
No tea. It has to be booze, and you can't be standing up because that's a shit show too. That just means you're outdoors. Okay. You know what I mean?
That's fair. Yeah.
Well, those are my rules. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
That's good. Expeditioners in Antarctica are now in what's known as the Twilight Zone, the actual Twilight Zone, after the sun set near a research station on Wednesday for the last time for 5 weeks. And I have some video of it that's pretty cool. The Australian Antarctic Program shared a video on Facebook on Wednesday of the sun going down on June 2nd near the research station. So they're not going to see it rise again until July 10th. They say they'll have about 3 hours of what they call civil twilight a day, with the sun between 0 and 6 degrees below the horizon. So it's kind of like, they said, it's like being on the dark side of the moon. They said the best thing to combat this is to maintain a routine of working, eating, and sleeping, or you are screwed.
You say Antarctica? Is that what we're talking about?
Antarctica.
Every single movie I've ever seen with any scientist or explorer that's in that neck of the woods, they're always really cool dudes. They got a lot of personality.
The Thing.
There's been many a movie and many a hero. I can't believe they're actual people that decide to do that are nearly as interesting as the people that portray them on the big screen, right? They got to be...
Oh yeah,
that's a crew. That's going to be a tough talk crew, right? Not chatty.
It's funny because a girlfriend of mine who I've known since I was in kindergarten has been to Antarctica many times because she's a marine biologist, and she's super cool, but not Shecky Green.
we should figure out if not today, then Shecky Green.
Not Shecky Green.
You're saying she's quiet and boring. I get it. That's my theory. Why would you go into that business? You go into that business because you hate the sun and you want to be left alone.
You care, and I'm putting words in her mouth, but if I were to be in that position, it would be because I cared more about the earth than people. Like, I want to save the earth. I want to see how the earth works, and I would like to very much go be alone for 3 months.
And nothing ever good comes out of those movies. Like, it's trouble. Then we start there, and then there's that fissure in the ice. You know what I mean? Like, what's going on? And you see the crack going in the ice shelf.
Yep.
Sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we should figure out, if not now, then soon, what professions in real life versus how they're portrayed in movies have the widest gap of coolness versus not coolness or whatever. Like, obviously, everyone thinks of mathematicians, engineers. Well, I'm going to throw out taxi drivers.
Oh, that's good.
There's always a wacky taxi driver in the movie for a full personality, full of charm.
The first one that, of course, comes to my mind, archaeologist. Yeah. You think there's more than one Indiana Jones?
Yeah, so true.
Professional gambler.
Yeah. Because that's just like the Asian guy wearing sunglasses and a ski beanie and super boring looking. Yeah, it's not the guy from Casino Royale. I didn't do Adam Carolla's Unprepared, so we'll do it in the next show, and you can give us a tweet or we'll get phone calls for the next.
We do phone calls. We do.
All right, let's do maybe one more. Is Delroy Zingis running on time?
Yeah, I heard he was running on time.
Okay.
All right. Well, if you're looking for a long distance partner and you live in Denmark, you're going to have to do some things that I've never heard of before, but I kind of like it. You have to prove that you're in love. You have to provide proof of love. So travel restrictions are being loosened for long distance couples who are married or engaged, have been dating for at least 6 months. And if you can present evidence upon your arrival into the country that you really are a couple in love, they will let you in.
See, Adam, you do wonder why these young kids put their pornos on the internet. This is like, you're the Dutch, you're at Dutch customs. Like, no, 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 just Google.
They can bring in a love letter, some a steamy pic.
This is the movie Green Card with Gerard Depardieu.
The guy, the police chief said, I realize these are very intimate things, but the decision to let in partner in the partner ultimately rests on the judgment of the individual police officer. And an online-only relationship isn't enough. You have to prove that you've had in-person relations, essentially, prior to the pandemic.
What am I saying?
Yeah, so I mean, the guy's like looking at your phone going, second base isn't really going to cut it. I need to see some digits dropped, or I need more areola.
Doesn't look official.
Like, yeah, that's kind of opening things up. It's kind of interesting. Kind of reminds me of that we're talking about the Supreme Court ruling or the senator from whatever, which is like, how do you define pornography? And they just go, I'll know it when I see it. And right. I guess you're leaving it up to a lot of guys to go, like, I'll know it. I'll know it if I see it. All right. Let's bring it home, because Delroy Lindo is going to pop on with us any second.
Very
now.
Good. I'm Gina Grad, and that's the news.
Gina Grad.
That was the news with Gina Grad.
Let me hit Geico, and then we'll jump on Delroy's train. Geico, I want to thank you for sharing your DIY haircuts and some of your fails, your inner lip sync stars on video and whatnot. And also, they're going to share with you at geico.com. They're going to give back 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers, because Geico's committed to long haul. The 15% credit lasts the full length of the policy, so you're not driving as much, and Geico gets it. They're going to kick it back. Geico.com/giveback for info and eligibility. Delroy Lindo, great actor, is going to be up right after this.
I'm your emotional support animal.
It shows just how fucking petrified of the Twitter mob every public figure is nowadays. The fact that they've talked good people who have never harmed anyone into giving preemptive apologies to nut jobs is outrageous.
Written and narrated by Adam Carolla.
Consequently, I'm starting with a warning. I'm not going to apologize for anything in this book.
Pre-order it now at AdamCarolla.com.
Delroy Lindo has joined us, the great actor. Good to see you, my friend. Where are you?
Thank you. I'm in Northern California. I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area.
All right.
That's usually
where are you?
What's
where,
that?
Where are you?
Glendale.
Where are you?
Glendale, California.
Oh. The only slightly less glamorous Glendale, California.
I understand. Yes.
The film, The Five Bloods, which is available June 12th on Netflix, has Delroy in it, and also Chadwick Boseman as well, and a lot of other very good actors. Spike Lee joint. Let's talk about the film.
The film is about four Vietnam vets who return to Vietnam in order to recover the remains of a comrade that they lost in 1971, as well as to retrieve some bullion, some gold bullion that they had been told to transport. And then the bullion gets lost. And so the purpose of these four men returning to Vietnam is to recover the remains, and if they get lucky, to recover this bullion.
How long?
Put it to a good use, a good socially responsible use.
How long has it been since you've worked with Spike Lee?
Do you have a calculator there?
Is it like 26 years or something?
Yeah, we last worked together on Clockers, a film called Clockers, which I believe was released in either 1995 or 1996. So that was the last time. So, 20, 4 years.
Oh, I was off by two. Sorry. Your parents were from Jamaica. I'm looking at here, and they immigrated to Britain, and then you found your way to the Bay Area. Is that the journey?
Well, yeah, there were some steps. That was the short version. I found my way to the Bay Area to study acting at a place called the American Conservatory Theater. You're correct. My mom, we are Jamaican. My mom was part of an influx of Caribbean people from the Caribbean to the United Kingdom that started in 1948. My mom arrived, I think, around 1951, which is how I came to be born in England. And my mom was part of this influx of hundreds of thousands of people from the Caribbean, emigrating from the Caribbean to the UK, and they became known as the Windrush Generation. And they were called the Windrush Generation because the boat that brought the first batch of Jamaican men to the UK in 1948, June 22nd, 1948, was called the Empire Windrush. Mm. So that's how I came to be born in England. My mom then left and went to Canada. I followed her. And eventually, as you say, I ended up in San Francisco in order to study at the American Conservatory Theater.
Well, now that we got all that out of the way, we can talk about Gone in 60 Seconds for the next 45 minutes. Because
not going to happen, bro.
Well, you know, Brian and I were talking. Well, here's a legitimate question. I think you'll find this legitimate. That movie's a guilty pleasure of mine, but I thought you were very strong in it. Like, your performance was very good. And is it more challenging to deliver? I think sometimes we undervalue the ability of guys to take kind of lighter weight material and make it better.
Supporting parts. Yeah. Okay. Without sounding, you know, it's hard to talk about acting without sounding, you know, but if I take your point, because that was, you know, a supporting role. But if you're applying yourself to the work and trying to get the truth out of every scene, then it resonates in whatever way it resonates, right? I can tell you, for instance, the first film that I ever did with Spike is a film called Malcolm X. That film is over 3 hours long. My character, West Indian Archie, is probably in that film for maybe, I don't know, 12 minutes, 3 hour film. But it resonated for actors. And that was because of the way it was written. There are these scenes that I have early on in the, or maybe midway through the film. But then there was a scene at the end of the film that completed West Indian Archie's dramatic journey, his narrative. And that kind of sewed everything together. So even though the film was only 3 hours long, I'm sorry, even though the film was over 3 hours long, but I am only in the film for a short, relatively short amount of time, it resonated because there was a journey that my character took. As far as Gone in 60 Seconds is concerned, I would say that, you know, I had a number of scenes with Nick Cage, who was, you know, the lead actor in the film, so that at very strategic points in the unfolding of the narrative, Nick is there and I am there. And the way that the story was set up is that Nick's character was my nemesis. So every scene that he and I are in together, we're kind of going at it. And I have no idea, but maybe that's the reason why you're saying, well, you were good in the film, because it resonated in a certain kind of way, just because even though it was a supporting part, I was there at very strategic points in the unfolding of that narrative.
In Malcolm X, your character did the Jamaican accent, and I'm guessing that was easier for you because of your mom or because of your childhood experiences. Is that why you were able to do it?
I am of Jamaican extraction. Therefore, I mean, while it's not a given that I could reproduce that accent, I was around Jamaicans, and my mom spoke with a softer Jamaican accent. But yeah, because I'm of Jamaican extraction, I could capture that accent.
Brian, I want to pull these two threads together, because when we talk about Jamaican accent or that accent, and you're talking about bang for your buck, you know, the limited screen time versus impact. I was ashamed that I forgot that. Remember the movie Adam, The Devil's Advocate, one of our favorites. Delroy was the character who was sacrificing the goats in New York, and they had to, like, it was a Keanu Reeves like first assignment, right, for his new law firm. And you were on the screen for 5 minutes, maybe, but I'll never forget. That's a great part.
Well, again, perhaps it's echoing what I said before. Mm. You know, Keanu Reeves is one of the lead actors in the film, and I'm in a scene with Keanu, and I'm cutting up these animals, which is kind of sort of memorable in and of itself. So therefore, perhaps it becomes then a memorable scene that resonates with audiences. And then there was a later scene in which we're in court.
Right.
And the judge has a coughing jag. He goes on this coughing fit, which prevents him from saying what he needs to say in terms of adjudicating the case. And the way that Taylor Hackford directed the film, and the way that he shot the scene, was that as this judge is kind of doubled over into hacking and coughing, he keeps panning back to me.
Mm-hmm. The implication being that you're the one obviously doing
this. Yes. And I'm just sitting there doing nothing. So I don't know. Maybe it is a corroboration of the fact it doesn't matter how long you're in a given piece of work or in a film. It matters what the content of the scenes are and how memorable they become in relationship to the whole, to the narrative overall.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's sort of your batting average, not the amount of trips to the plate, but how often. I used to do Howard Stern all the time, and people always liked me on Howard Stern, and they would say, how do you do so well on Howard Stern? And I would say, I don't talk unless I have a good joke or something funny to say. So I would just be quiet for 10 minutes, and then I would say something funny, and then I'd be quiet again. And at the end, they don't really care how much you spoke. They just want to know the average of the jokes that you told.
Or the content of the joke, right?
Right.
Was the joke was it funny? Did it make people laugh? Did it resonate for the audience? Did the audience respond? And if they got a good laugh out of whatever it was that you said, then chances are it became a memorable moment in the program.
I see a drum kit behind you in your, what I hope.
My son.
Oh, that's your son.
My son. Yeah. My son, I was going to say was a musician. My son's a ball player now. My son plays basketball. And so the drums don't get played as much. But from the time my son was very, very young, he exhibited this aptitude for the drums. So I got him his first drum set when he was probably, I don't know, two or three. This is probably the last drum set we got for him.
You're 6'4", right?
No, my son is 6'4". I'm 6'2". And my son loves the fact that he is taller than dad. couldn't wait, God dog it. No, I'm 6'2". I'm 6'2".
Oh, it's funny. I thought I was reading up on you, and I, for some reason, thought I read 6'4". But I always thought of you as tall. Is your son playing ball? Is he? How old is he?
Yeah, he actually, my son is soon to be 19 years old, and he just got a scholarship. Full ride, actually.
He's a St. Mary's.
He was a St. Mary's. How did you know St. Mary's?
I Googled him, and his Twitter bio popped up, said shooting guard at St. Mary's College.
No, St. Mary's.
Oh, St. Mary's College High School. That's what I get for not reading the whole thing. I apologize.
That's why the Google man.
I know, man. I gotta be more thorough on that.
But listen, I want to ask the lady to ask a question. The dude, you're hogging the conversation.
Oh my God. A man after my own heart.
Pipe down, bro.
Okay. Bye. First of all, when you're talking about your Jamaican background, it just made me remember that in college we were doing I've come from a theater background, and we were doing dialect classes, and we could choose anything we wanted. And I'm from Kansas, and I know nothing about nothing, especially at that time. And I chose patois because it seemed like the most
Jamaican patois.
Yeah. Jamaican patois.
Why did you do that?
Because it seemed incredibly, it was incredible. Foreign to me. And I met this incredible woman from Jamaica, and I asked her to help me break everything down. And
she's from Kansas.
I'm from Kansas. Okay. And it was the most exciting dialect work I had done. But the way you break things down just in these conversations, and forgive me for not knowing in advance, but I would be very surprised if you weren't teaching acting.
I've taught acting, and I really enjoy teaching acting. When I say I've taught acting, I've run workshops. I got a degree from NYU a number of years ago, and I taught some workshops at NYU. I went a few years ago to the University of Michigan and did a day of workshops there. But I have not taught on an ongoing basis, and I would rather not teach.
Why is that?
Two responses. I think I'm stronger going in for a short amount of time, sharing what I know, and then leaving it to the students to disseminate whatever it is I've said, and to make sense of it or not. I have the feeling that were I to have to deal with students on an ongoing basis, I'm not sure. I don't know, but I'm not sure I would have the patience for that.
Fair enough.
For instance, when I did my workshop at the University of Michigan, I was helping the kids with some scene work. They all got up and they either did a monologue or a scene, and I gave feedback. And this one young man got up and he did a monologue, and I gave him some feedback. And he said, I'm not quoting, he said words to the effect, "Wow, what you just said really makes sense to me." One of the things I had said to him had to do with how to create a biography for the character that you're playing. In other words, how to create, you said you're from a theater background.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you know the importance of that.
Of course.
Right. You say, of course. This kid said to me, I said, as you're creating a given character, you know, it can sometimes be really helpful if you create a biography for that character. And then I said some very specific things about the monologue I had seen him do. And he said to me, "Huh, that makes really good sense. I never saw the need to do to create a biography in the past." He was a senior.
Oh my
God. He was about to graduate.
I never saw the need to know who I was as this character.
That's right. He was a senior. Now, right. So if I had to deal with that kind of thing on an ongoing basis, it would probably drive me nuts.
Well said.
Gina, can I ask a question?
Wait a second.
Adam.
Wait. I'm not through talking to Gina. Okay? Gina, I'll give you one other. I was directing a play, and I love directing also. And I was directing a wonderful play, and the actors were doing extraordinary, wonderful work. One of the actors that I had hired, I hired this actor, and she was kind of sort of having a hard time with the material. And one day she had a breakthrough. And I said, "That's it. That's it right there. Whatever you were working on in that moment, it really worked." And she said to me, "Yeah, but I don't know how to recreate that." And this was somebody who had just graduated Juilliard. the drama school, 4 years at Juilliard. And while when she said, yeah, but I don't, how do I create, recreate that? And it was, not only was it very disturbing to me, but it landed on me someplace where I understood it and I helped her and we worked and she was wonderful in the production. But when she said that, it was just very, very dispiriting to me. And I'm not sure how I would react and respond on an ongoing basis if I had to deal with that kind of, those kinds of comments and being dispirited on a daily basis. I just don't know that I would be good at that.
You're better off at being the special guest and then getting out.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Can you teach people to act? I mean, I'll make an analogy. Everyone can kind of play.
Adam's asking for a friend.
No, I mean, everyone can kind of play sports, but you're not going to be able to play it at a high level. You have to be athletic to really play it at a high level.
Time. Everybody can't play sports.
Well, I mean, they can participate.
Wait, I'm going to tell you. Okay, so I'll give you a story. And then I'm going to promise I'll let you finish your question. My son used to play soccer when he was very young. I had him playing soccer, which actually has helped his basketball because his footwork is great and he has vision. He sees the court. Anyhow, my son was probably, I don't know, eight or nine playing soccer. And my son is a good athlete. So he's pretty good. Maybe he was 10. There was a little kid on his team that clearly did not want to be there, and his father had kind of forced him to be there. I remember he got on the field, and literally during the game, and the ball is downfield, and this kid was back closer to the defensive end of the field, and he knelt down and started picking blades of grass in the middle of the game. And his father, who I was standing next to, had steam coming out of his ears. And the kid was picking blades of grass. And the kid doesn't want to be here. He's not an athlete, man. Give it up. So that's my story. Go ahead.
Well,
as you're saying,
not everyone is good at sports. But what I mean is anyone can go to a park and get into a pickup basketball game and be bad, but they can participate. Anyone can do a school play. But certain people are gifted and they're athletes, you know, and we all understand foot speed, vertical leap, you know, upper body strength, all that. Is it kind of analogous with acting? Like, if you're not an athlete, do you need to be able to, I mean, we all know people, you couldn't teach them to act. It would be a waste of time, right?
Maybe not a waste of time from the standpoint that if you are pursuing this and if you have it in your heart to pursue this, I am not going to tell you not to pursue it. What I hope, if you are exhibiting an eminent lack of talent, if you are eminently just talentless, what I hope for you is that you will realize that at some point. I went to acting school. I went to the American Conservatory Theater. There were young people, young men there, and there were two in particular I'm thinking of who were in class that I was in class with, and they just didn't have it. They just didn't have it. And it was clear that they didn't have it. So the answer to you, and they were in an acting conservatory. So my response to your question is, fundamentally, I don't think acting can be taught. Here's the question. Yeah, I think you have to have, here's the response. You have to have something to work with.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You got to have something to work with. You have to have some area that can be built upon and developed. If you just don't have it, you just don't have it.
I agree. And again, it's sort of, it's like high level athletics. Like you can teach and you can coach, but if you just don't have that kind of coordination, that foot speed, you're not going to make it out on the field. But then what is it? What is acting? Like, is it an intellectual process? Would you say
it's not intellectual. It's not intellectual.
What is it? So is it like saying, I have a musical ear. It doesn't make me smarter. It doesn't make me a greater intellect. I just have the ability to hear someone play something on the piano and mimic it or write my own. Is it analogous to that?
Yeah. But what you just, that's a gift. If you have a musical ear and you are able to hear somebody play something on the piano and then, as you say, mimic it or play it, that's a gift. That's a talent. If you... I would say to you that if you have a musical ear, that means you have a certain relationship to music, as opposed to somebody who has what we call a tin ear, who can't hear it, who can't appreciate it. So with regard to acting, okay, this is what I'll say to you. If a young person comes to me and says, Mr. Leno, I want to be an actor. Invariably, my response, I have a couple of responses. Why do you want to be an actor? Why? Why do you want to act? And depending on their response will determine for me what my next response to them is. Frequently, not infrequently, I find myself saying to young people, okay, if you want to act, God bless you. But I will say this to you. If there is anything that you can do, if there's anything else that you can do other than act and be happy doing that, go do that. Because acting is too hard, it's too difficult, and the industry, which is eminently not a meritocracy, it is not a meritocracy. The industry is just too hard. And from a business point of view, from a career point of view, there are way too many obstacles that get thrown in your face. You have to be able to take rejection as a fundamental part of your personality. You have to, because you're going to hear no far more than you hear the word yes. So if you are built to withstand all of that and can still pursue the career and the craft, go do it. God bless you. If you're not built like that, with all due respect, I would suggest that you go and find something else.
Wait, are you talking to me or is this still the hypothetical? I felt like that was aimed. Felt like it was heading for me.
You know who Bob Marley is, man?
Sure.
Musical. Okay, he has a song called
Hold On. Let me be the whitest guy in the world. Robert who?
Yeah, Bob Marley. He had a song called If the Cap Fits. So, hey, it's on you.
You said meritocracy and not a meritocracy. Can we explore that a little bit?
Well, it's not about who's talented. Simple as that. Success, excuse me, being talented does not guarantee success as an actor. There are all these other components that contribute to one's success, longevity as an actor. Talent is one component. There are all these other components that directly contribute to who achieves success as an actor. And the other piece is who is able to maintain a longevity in their careers.
Brian, you got a question? Sorry.
I sort of did, but I'm going to put you on the spot, Mr. Lindo, if you don't mind. I'm wondering if there's any, I've always wondered this, especially from an actor's point of view, someone who's been in the industry for a long time. Are there any people who we dismiss as movie stars who you're like, oh no, that's a really good actor or actress. Right. I'll give you a second to think about it, because I always thought of Tom Cruise. He's Tom Cruise, right? He's a big star. He's international, blah, blah, blah. He's a really good actor and he's gotten better. He's turned in some amazing performances like later in his career.
Did you see a film called Magnolia?
I own
exactly
Magnolia.
Exactly what I was thinking. Yep.
Terrific in Magnolia.
He was robbed of an Oscar for that movie.
I won't go that far. I don't know who else was. No. I'm not being facetious. I don't know who else was nominated that year or who was in his category, but he was very good. I think of Will Smith. Will Smith in Six Degrees of Separation. He was terrific. One of the first films he did. He was terrific in that. Believable. He has since become a movie star, but he was terrific, I thought, in Six Degrees. And there was a film he did a few years ago. I want to say it was called 8 Seconds.
Mm-hmm. No, it was 7 Pounds.
Yeah. 7 Pounds.
8 Seconds was a rodeo, movie.
That was Luke Perry.
Luke Perry.
Oh, no. Yeah. No. So 7 Pounds. He was very good in that. Movie star. He's become a movie star. And there's also a film that he did called Not a Beautiful Mind. That was Russell.
Pursuit of Happiness?
The Pursuit of Happiness.
Yeah, he was great. Very
good in that. And in those films, and there may be other films, the films of Will Smith that I have seen, he did really good work as an actor in those films. He's also a movie star. So
yeah.
I'll tell you somebody else who became a movie star. She won an Academy Award for...
I can buy you a second and tell you that Tom Cruise lost to Michael Caine for Cider House Rules, which Delroy was in, in 2000.
So listen, so wait a minute. Is that the best supporting category?
Yes.
So there was somebody else who should have been nominated that year. Do you know who it is?
In 2000 in supporting?
Delroy Lindo for Cider House Rules.
Right. There you go. That's right.
I didn't say it. You said it. So moving right along. Who won the Academy Award, Best Actor, Best Actress, for a film with Billy Bob Thornton? She was in Spike's film.
Halle Berry?
Halle Berry.
Well done. Yes, Halle for Berry. Monster.
Halle
Monster.
Berry is Monster. A fine actor.
Yeah.
She became a big movie star. But a really good actor. But to your question, to your original question, are there people that I dismiss?
Nope.
No. Because
It was people who are dismissed generally who I was wondering who you really respect as actors. And you answered my question, so that's perfect. Thank you.
I've answered the question, right?
That's perfect.
Yes. Let's see it from the young lady.
Gina, your turn.
I love this man. Well, you know, the first when Brian said that, the first name that comes to mind, although now we see him, you know, as a legitimate movie star. Think about the old 21 Jump Street days. People didn't give Johnny Depp a second look.
Right.
And he's really proved himself as an incredible actor.
Fine actor. Yeah, for sure. He's a very good actor. Absolutely. I have to ask you guys a question. How much longer do we have in this? Because I really need to talk a little bit about the Five Bloods.
Sorry. Yeah. Let's go right into that. Why don't we go right into that?
So that film is important. This film is important for a number of reasons, because it is a film that, presents the Vietnam experience through the lens of these five African-American vets. And due to the fact, and you guys may disagree, and if you disagree, I'd like to hear why, but usually in films of conflict, the contributions of black soldiers are either marginalized or expurgated altogether. And the reason that this film is important is because it flips that whole thing. And now we are seeing a film that not only presents the Vietnam experience through the lens of the experience of these five African-American men, but we also see we get exposed to their humanity and their love. In my estimation, it is a love story between these five men. Mm-hmm. And what I'm hoping is that if audiences can see that, acknowledge that, feel that, you will get a window into black maleness that ordinarily does not get portrayed on screen.
I know the timing is horrible for this, but I totally disagree. It's a joke.
You're being facetious.
Yes.
Okay, you talk from comedy, right?
Well, it's interesting because I never thought about, especially as it pertains to Vietnam films, the ones that pop to mind, the big Apocalypse Now, Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, on and on and on. There's the black guy. Oh, go ahead, please.
Stop. Good. Those three films. You said I never thought about it. The films that spring to mind are Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, and
Apocalypse Now.
That proves my point. Even though I don't quite put Full Metal Jacket in the same. I don't put them in the same category just because Dorian Harewood was in that film. Mm-hmm. But they kill him. They kill him off. You know, I don't know, less than halfway through the film. But Platoon and Apocalypse, there are a couple black soldiers in Platoon. Johnny Depp is in that film. He's got a big part in that film.
Lawrence Fishburne, isn't Lawrence Fishburne the young black guy in Apocalypse Now?
Lawrence Fishburne? He was like 15 when he was in that, wasn't he?
Apocalypse.
Apocalypse Now, yeah.
That's true. But when you think about, you said it. You said, I never really thought about it. Because either in war films, our presence is not central to, not central, not fundamental to how the narratives are told. Mm-hmm. And in this, we are front and center. And not only are we front and center, and this is not an ego thing from my point of view. It is, from my standpoint, it is from a human point of view. What I am hoping is that not only does it serve as a historical corrective in terms of representing more fully what our contribution was to the Vietnam War, but also the fact that we are presented as human beings with all of our foibles, all of our faults. But that goes to the center of our humanity. So I want to say that. I need to say that. And we can talk about Gone in 60 Seconds now if you want to.
Please.
For 60 seconds.
No, I was reading that... Your character's a Trump supporter in the film, and that you were arguing with Spike that that's what I read.
I was not arguing with Spike, but I did try to dissuade Spike from making me a Trump supporter because that individual is antithetical to everything that I stand for and believe in. And so the fact that I would be portraying a supporter was not something I wanted to embrace. I also said to Spike, man, I have at that time, a 17-year-old son. He's now 18. A 17-year-old son. I don't want him to see me doing this. Spike thought about it. So what I said to Spike was, can we make my character, Paul, a conservative, an arch conservative? I don't mind being an arch conservative without being a Trump supporter. Spike thought about it. He called me up maybe 3-4 days later and said, no, man, I really need for Paul, my character Paul, to be a Trump supporter. I said to Spike, okay, you know what? Give me, he said to me, if you don't want to play this part, you can play, and he offered me another part. There was another part. He said, you can play this part. I said, okay, I'll tell you what. Give me the weekend. I'm going to read the script again. And I'll call you next week. He said, cool, no problem. I took another 2 or 3 days and I read the script 2 more times. So now I'd read the script 3 times. And what became clear to me was that Paul was the part I needed to play. Paul was the part I was going to play. Paul is an extraordinary, you guys have not seen the film, but I hope you go see the film. But Paul is a large Shakespearean, Wilsonian tragic character. And in the additional second and third time that I read the script, I was able to rationalize in my head how my character could have arrived at a place in his life where he voted the way he did in 2016. So once I was over that stumbling block, I was fine. And I wanted to take on all the various other aspects of this character, which are phenomenal. So it was not an argument with Spike, but I did say, Spike, I'd rather not, man.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said argument, but there was a discussion about it. By the way, we don't have to go see the film. It'll be out June 12th on Netflix, so we can all enjoy it from where we are. I was laughing in my head thinking about your son and how you'd have to sort of pitch him or discuss with him being a Trump supporter. And
no, I don't, because he knows I'm not.
I mean the character being a Trump supporter, which is I'm picturing him going, Dad, can't you go back and play one of those roles where you sacrifice animals? Why do you have to be a Trump supporter?
I tell you what. A few weeks ago, Spike arranged a special screening for the cast of the film. We all watched, obviously, remotely from our homes. And my son, the whole family watched it. And that didn't come. Two things. It didn't come up. My son accepted, quote unquote, this person he was seeing on screen, which he clearly knew was not me. But the one thing that he said was at one point he leaned into the screen and he said, Dad, what's up with your teeth, man? And that was cute. That was funny to me because I had a false set of teeth made for myself, upper and lower. And it's a small thing. It was entirely for my own process as I was creating this film. And I'll tell you where it came from. There's a book called Bloods, edited by a man named Wallace Terry. And I'd read Bloods in the 70s. And in preparation to doing this film, I went back and reread the book. And the book Bloods is are verbatim accounts of Black Vietnam vets. And there are photographs of the vets who are in the book. And in one of the photographs, one of the vets is smiling. And I was looking at his teeth. And I just had this idea that I wanted Paul's teeth in the film not to be as perfect as my teeth are. And so I called my dentist and I had my dentist make a cast of my teeth. And one of the gentlemen on the film made this set of crooked teeth for me, upper and lower. It's something probably most audiences will miss. It wasn't for show, right? It wasn't for me to say to the audience, look at my teeth and see how crooked they are. It was just a character trait that I wanted to incorporate. But my son caught it.
Well, I'm thinking back on that conversation you had with that acting student where you were telling him to create this world for the character. Yeah. And they were going, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, Pops. I hadn't given that much thought. But the fact that you read the script three times, you reread the book Bloods, that kind of detail, that's why you are who you are. Gina, I'm going to let Gina ask the last question since that seems to be the theme of the day.
Before I get to Gina, I want to say that in addition to that, I spoke with a number of vets. I read a number of books in addition to Bloods. Two of the first vets that I spoke with are my cousins, both of whom were in Nam, and both of whom have suffered with PTSD. One of the central things in the film is that I'm suffering from severe PTSD. So I spoke with my cousins. I then spoke with a number of additional vets and read a number of books, looked at documentaries. So what I was doing was inundating myself with this Vietnam information and by way of creating a foundation for myself as I started this work. Gina, your question.
Well, wait. Now, sorry, I've got one more. The man has one more question.
Man, give the space, man. Come on now.
How close did you come to Vietnam? I mean, you're
No. I'm young. I was too young. One. I was only 16 in 1968. That's one. And two, I was in Europe, so I was a number of steps.
Because it was still going on in 70 when you were 18.
No, for sure. But no, I did not go to Nam. And frankly, I was educated, phenomenally educated, much more about Vietnam, about the Vietnamese, about the whole Vietnam experience as a result of the research that I undertook in preparation for this film. Gina, what's your question?
I have a couple questions rolling through my brain, but just from what you told us about the character of Paul and a little bit of the soul searching that you had to do with it in general, because it seems like there was a, for lack of a better word, a breakthrough with you embracing that character in that role. In general, do you feel that you have a personal responsibility when it comes to who you're cast as and who you're willing to play? And if so, has that changed with this character?
I do have a responsibility. I have a responsibility. It has not changed with this character because the job, my job as an actor in any part that I play, is to find the humanity and to empathize and to understand why this person is the way that he is. Going back to the cider house rules, which I assume you guys have not seen.
No, we've seen
Okay. So you've seen the film and you know what my character does in that film. And that was a film that I did not, that was a part that I did not want to play. And I actually turned it down. I said, I don't want to do this. No, I'm not doing this. And the director changed. It was a new director. We met and we had a wonderful lunch, which he paid for, which was wonderful. That always helps. And he said, I'm sorry, you know, the part is the part. It is what it is. And I said, you know, God bless you. Thank you for lunch. But no, I'm not your guy. He then came back to me again to play the part. I then, Gina, to your question, went through a process where I could rationalize in for myself how Mr. Rose comes to have an incestuous relationship with his daughter. And once I was able to, I'm not going to say that empathize. I'm not going to say that, but I created a process, a biography, a past, a history for myself.
Yeah. A roadmap.
Thank you. Where I could see how that act could happen. And essentially, I'll tell you what it was. I won't give you the details, but essentially it had to do with the depth of the love that I have for my daughter, depth of the love and protection for her that I have for my daughter, Rose, played by wonderfully by Erykah Badu. The depth and breadth of the love that I have for her is such that at a certain point, it slips over into this other thing.
Well said.
I'm going to answer your question. You said you had two questions.
Well, my other question, just because I love finding out the answer to this, and I think everybody does. What kind of role, stage or screen, or if you have something specific, have you not conquered yet that you're really hoping to do during the span of your career?
I've always wanted to play the part of Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey was a Jamaican man who in the 19 teens came to New York from Jamaica and formed an organization called the UNIA, the United Negro Improvement Association. And his ethos had to do with taking black people, African descended people, back to Africa, because that's where he felt the homeland was. He was hugely powerful. The UNIA had members all over the world. It was thousands and thousands and thousands of members strong in New York alone, but he had members all over the world, and he became too powerful. And they meaning his enemies, destroyed him. They finally got him on some kind of income tax something. And he ended up dying in England. And I think was buried in a pauper's grave at the end. But my answer to your question is I've always wanted to play Marcus Garvey. I may be too old right now, but it's an extraordinary story. That's the answer to your question.
Wonderful.
Thanks, Delroy. No, I just appreciate you coming on. And again, Defy Bloods, available June 12th on Netflix. Watch it. And I hope we can do this again soon, maybe even in person.
God bless you. Thank you so much. You guys take care. All the very, very best to you.
Thank you.
All right. So
is the person from Netflix with us?
Oh, no, she, no? no, she's not here.
Okay, I'm going to leave. All right, you guys. God bless.
Bye.
All right. I'm going to be doing live shows coming up Nashville, Tennessee at Zany's June 12th and 13th. So we'll do live podcasts and live stand-up shows there as well. I'm your emotional support animal, available for pre-order because it's shipping real soon now, middle of June. And we'll do Adam Carolla's Unprepared from Quarantine Monday, June 15th, 7 p.m. Pacific time. Register at SiriusXM.com/Adam Carolla. Well, that was an interesting conversation.
I'll say. Nice contender job. For guest of the year.
Yeah, nice job, Gina and Bald, for that very, very good assist there.
Thanks. He's very easy to speak to.
Yeah, but he has a lots kind of a say. Relaxed intensity to him. I don't know if that, that works, but it works for me. All right. And live shows ever. Go to AdamCarolla.com until next time. It's Adam Carolla for Delray Lindo and Mark Garagos and Gina and Bald Brian saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, comes out on June 16th. Pre-order it. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.